Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the SITREP podcast. RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, is the world's oldest think tank for defence and security. It has contributed to British defence thinking for nearly 200 years. Today, its research is used around the world to understand threats and plan military capability that can respond. Since 2015, RUSI has been led by Dr. Karen von Hippel, who came to the job from the US State Department and then helping lead the global military coalition fighting the Islamic State terror group. Back then, Barack Obama was in the White House, and while Russia had just annexed Crimea from Ukraine, our focus was the jihadist threat in the Middle East. So, as Dr. von Hippel prepares to step down from RUSI, we've been talking about the many things that have happened during her nine-year tenure and what else may lie ahead.
When I started, it was pre-pandemic, it was pre-Brexit, it was pre-Trump. So lots of seismic shifts have happened during that period. It was, so we've gone through not just, as I mentioned, Brexit, Trump won, the pandemic, but then we have also gone through really a much more assertive China on the global stage. We've seen conflicts, significant conflicts in Europe with Ukraine and Russia, seen significant conflicts in the Middle East. And so it seems that things are getting more and more insecure. But in if you step back, I think, and you take the longer term approach, I think that there has been this shift underway for a couple decades where, you know, American power hasn't necessarily been eroded, but other countries are rising and competing and making the world more multipolar. And then at times when the United States has not pushed back, such as the red lines in Syria, you know, other countries interpret inaction as much as they interpret action. And so other countries, Russia, Iran, China, have been asserting themselves in ways that they may not have done in the past. And they're getting away with it because the U.S. is not able to push back in the same way. The U.S. is not able often to rally the allies in the same way that they did even during the counter-ISIL coalition.
And you came to RUSI from being chief of staff to General John Allen, who was the US lead for the fight against the Islamic State terror group. We now see, just as that global coalition is being wound down, fighting in Syria is suddenly surging again. I wonder what you make of where we are now.
Well, I think Syria is a little bit more complicated because that's the Syrian civil war that I actually started working on when I was in the US government, but I was doing it from a different part of the State Department. It was less about the Islamic State because the Islamic State hadn't been formed at that point, but it was more about the Syrian civil war, the Arab Spring. Remember the heyday when we thought, oh, everyone's going to become democratic. And then, of course, the Syrian civil war went the wrong direction. I mean, we were actually planning for Assad to be out in, you know, a few months because that was similar to what happened in Tunisia and even in Egypt. But that didn't happen, as we know. And so in a sense, this is almost a resurrection of the civil war. It never ended, but it's been basically on hold, you know, with each camp in its corner. And I think that the opposition organizations have come together, they've coalesced because they've seen Iran weakened by Israel, they've seen Russia distracted by Ukraine, and they very smartly thought this is the time to push ahead. Now, who knows what these groups together as a coalition will actually do? I mean, they claim one thing, you know, they have a Islamist background, but they're claiming something very different and something more modern. But we will have to see if they win. And we've already seen now the Assad regime pushing back in a really brutal way that it had done during the civil war. So unless other countries can put pressure on Assad, you know, to go to the negotiating table or better yet, to leave the country, it could just get ugly again. The war could drag on again like we're seeing in Libya or in a few other places.
And does the current upsurge in fighting in Syria pose a risk to us?
There is a risk that the war, if it spreads in Syria again, if it expands like it had done in the past, could, you know, contribute to more refugees leaving the country. I mean, several million Syrians are already outside of the country. Not many have come back. A few are coming back now to Aleppo just to see their property, but I'm not sure they'll stay because already we've seen some bombing campaigns by the regime with the support of Russia. But certainly, yeah, if it deteriorates, you know, we might see another humanitarian crisis. And that's, you know, quite ironic because, of course, as we know, Turkey in the last few months has been trying to say to the so-called guests that they should go home. Turkey calls them guests because that way they don't have to comply with some of the international refugee laws. But Turkey has been very generous and hosting millions of Syrians over the years, as has Jordan, Lebanon, and many European countries too.
And the rise of IS and the Syrian civil war back in 2014 went hand in hand. So could this opposition surge in Syria also create a renewed jihadist power base?
It's possible that this recent fighting in Syria could lead to a resurgence of some form of the so-called Islamic State coalescing again. I'm sure that they will be watching very carefully and trying to decide how they can jump in. They were weakened significantly in a military sense, by the coalition. And certainly, I think it was mostly eradicated in 2016, 2017. It's possible. I don't know. I mean, this coalition opposition group is saying right now that they are not going to adhere to those kind of religious strictures. I think they would recognize that that might cause international response in the way in the past. So at the moment, I don't think so, but you never know. I mean, we can't defeat the ideology, as many people have said. We can defeat these groups militarily, but they will exist. They'll spread out. They're networked. They're online. They're all over the world, and so they can come together again if they have the ability and they find an opening in a vacuum, basically.
And Russia is getting more involved again. Could US and UK also have to get hands on in Syria again?
I think behind the scenes there will be huge attempts by the UN, by others, to mediate. I think that's happening now by the United Kingdom, the United States, the French, and others to mediate behind the scenes. Many of the Arab states will have more sway and more pull over Assad. It's really hard to tell if they will regain control in about a week or so, or if this is the beginning of the end for the Assad regime. I would hope so, because he's done so much damage and he's a very weak leader. He really doesn't control the country. He rules through force and through fear, and it's just not sustainable. And Syrians, of course, deserve better.
The withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 is an absolutely pivotal moment from your time leading, Roussi. It's already firmly in the history books as disastrous for the US, the UK and NATO allies. What lessons do you think we should be taking from that?
I think the lesson from the US withdrawal from Afghanistan was that certainly the lesson the Americans took, and I've read, Jake Sullivan and others talking about this, they just didn't anticipate the worst case scenario when they planned for the withdrawal. It wasn't a surprise that Biden wanted to withdraw. He was hoping to pull out even when Obama was president. He was vice president. He had signaled that he thought that intervention should end for many years. But yes, the way it was done was just horrific, and we all saw that on television. But I'm not sure it was, of course, it's a tragedy for Afghans. It's a tragedy in particular for Afghan women. But I'm not sure that it has. I mean, of course, I think it messaged to, the message it sent out to leaders like Putin was that the U.S. is weak and it's losing its grip, et cetera. But I think the U.S. has reasserted itself, certainly in Ukraine. So I'm not entirely sure that record, has totally changed your perception about U.S. power.
And do you think Washington, London and other capitals understand the lessons from Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly I know America knows that it didn't plan for the worst. The problem will be that as you change administrations, very often the new administration, especially if it's from a different party, will just throw everything out the window that the other party did, because they'll say, well, we know better. I mean, we even saw that with George Bush when he invaded Iraq back in 2003. He didn't listen to anything that had gone before, past interventions that were a little bit more successful, let's just say, in the Balkans and elsewhere. They thought they knew better. And I think that's often the problem, is that you get hubris by these various political parties when they take power. I mean, you see that everywhere, not just in the United States. So they often ignore past lessons. And that is a shame.
And as you leave, Roussi, two major wars are underway. Let's start with the Middle East. Is it possible to see a path to the end of the tangled conflicts that make up the war right now?
So there's different pieces of the war in the Middle East, right? So there's the Israel-Hezbollah conflict. And, hopefully, it's already, you know, it's hard to say that truce is very weak and very shaky, but I think, you know, that they can come to an agreement on that and they can respect it. They just need a lot of pressure on both sides to make that happen. And I actually think Trump's team would be very solid on that. They're quite close to Netanyahu. Gaza's more complicated, and I think he's going to have to be put under a lot of pressure to, you know, be thinking in a serious way about a two-state solution. I don't know how Trump will deal with that. I mean, last time around, yes, they had a success with the Abraham Accords, but they also completely marginalized Palestinians in that process. And so I think that they will, you know, be under pressure from Saudi Arabia and a few other countries for a two-state solution soon. Not sure how they'll manage that. I'm not sure even if Trump might go the other direction and say, oh yes, all of West Bank, we recognize that as Israel sovereignty. I just don't know what they're going to do. You know, you hope for one thing, but then you need to prepare that they may do the opposite.
And what about Ukraine? Nearly 3 years into the full-scale war, but actually it began in 2014 before you started it, Russi. Can you see any pathway to the end of that?
Yeah, well, there's an easy pathway to the end of the war in Ukraine with Russia withdrawing, but that obviously is not going to happen. But if the Ukrainians can make some progress before, on the ground anyway, before the changeover in January, the U.S. administration, it'll at least help at the negotiating table. Biden's change in policy in allowing the Ukrainians to use these long-range attack-ems, the U.S. ones can go travel as far as about 190 miles. The British Storm Shadows or the French Scalp can go about 150, 155 miles into Russia. And really, the purpose of these long-range missiles, the use of these, is to enable the Ukrainians to defend themselves. I mean, the Russians are shooting at Ukrainian civilian infrastructure, you know, whether it's electricity, heating plants, or, you know, apartment buildings from way inside Russia. It's hard for them to defend themselves. So if they can take out some of these military bases where the attacks are coming from, that, you know, that could be significant. I think the real challenge in Ukraine will be if there is an agreement, you know, if Trump is able to push them to the negotiating table and there's some sort of agreement that's seen as fair by the Ukrainians, and that's a big if, then what kind of security guarantees will the Ukrainians get to prevent Russia from coming back? Now, I don't think they will get into NATO in the near future, unfortunately, but they will need some sort of security guarantees. Otherwise, they'll just keep fighting because they'll say, you know, why do we stop? It's just going to give Russia a chance to regroup and rearm, and then they'll come back for more.
And for many of us, it's hard to look at what's happening in the world right now and have any long-term optimism. You have a much more detailed understanding, not just of the daily battlefield reporting, but also the diplomatic and the political structures that are in play. Do you have any optimism that this time of significant conflict might just end up being a blip in historic terms rather than a slide towards greater global conflict?
Sure, we're going to see greater global conflict, but I think it's going to be more fragmented. I think, you know, the U.S. losing its sole superpower status has already changed the global balance of power. It's, you know, not just China as a major significant threat, but really it's a more multipolar world, and smaller countries can cause much more damage even without, you know, a big nuclear arsenal, as we've seen. So smaller countries can do all sorts of things online with misinformation. So it's much easier to poke other countries. And then we've seen countries like Russia, which, you know, economically is not a very strong country. Militarily, it is. But they've been able to punch way above their weight because it's an authoritarian system. And if they can poke all over the world. I mean, whether it's Romania or Georgia or the U.S. elections or in the United Kingdom, they're able to not just, you know, promote misinformation, but, you know, they've caused fires, warehouse attacks. They've killed people, even their own citizens overseas, or tried to kill their citizens, as with Sergei Skripal in the U.K. So, you know, we're going to see more of that. And I think, you know, with Trump coming in, who is not a believer in alliances and partnerships, we're going to probably have more ad hoc coalitions to address different types of challenges. So like-minded countries coming together, whether it's to deal with climate change or to deal with Ukraine, but not necessarily in the grander way that we've seen in the past.
And on a personal note, what was it about Russi that made you want to take on the job of leading the Institute?
Gosh, that's a great question. I'm not sure I knew what I was getting into when I said yes. I was a big fan of the Institute. I always, I like living in the UK. Obviously, I've spent about 20 plus years of my life here. But it's been a lot of fun. I mean, RUSI is an independent think tank. We do a lot of great work in areas that I'm interested in. So, it was an honor for me to be able to help grow the Institute and, provide what I could to support the people that work there. There's a lot of great scholars and non-scholars who work at RUSI. And so, helping them come together to do more has been really, something that I'm quite proud of. I mean, we've done this as a team. Is, it's the only ways you can succeed in these kinds of organizations is if everybody is working together for the same goal. And I think we have achieved that at RUSI.
And when you say you're not sure what you're getting into, what did you expect or what was the reality?
Well, I mean, RUSI was a smaller think tank back then, and the world was a different place. And so, just thinking about, and, you often don't know what a job entails when you're far away from it. I was still in the State Department when I was recruited to join RUSI. And so I think my mind was a bit far away from a think tank. I had worked at think tanks in the past, so I had experience in that sense. But I think, just not entirely sure what kind of influence, what kind of reach RUSI had. I didn't really know the people that well back then. And so, a lot of it was just a bit unknown, but that's okay. That's kind of fun to, that's part of the learning process is seeing what people, what kind of skills people have and what an institute can do.
And what do you think is the most important work that RUSI has produced in your time leading the institute?
I think there's a range of products that we've come up with. I mean, of course, I think a lot of people, may know us because of our work on Ukraine, and we've done a great job covering Ukraine from many angles, not just the military battlefield, but also sanctions, looking at integrity of the Ukrainian financial system or the integrity of Ukraine's government post-conflict, helping to promote that financial integrity. But we've looked at cyber, we've looked at the nuclear threats. So we've looked at the Ukrainian conflict from many different angles, many different research teams at RUSI. But then, beyond that, we do really impressive work, I think, on organized crime. We do a lot of work on, obviously, financial crime and fraud. We look at nuclear deterrence. We look at civilian nuclear power. So geopolitics, Middle East. I mean, there's a lot more going on, North Korea, et cetera, that we do at RUSI. But perhaps we may be best known for Ukraine. But I think that for various different niche areas, RUSI's made very important contributions, I think, to the debates in the UK and globally.
And yeah, you say, a lot of people do know RUSI's name, but and as you point out, not necessarily the breadth of work that you're involved in. How does that work feed into helping our defence and security?
We try to provide all think tanks do this. They try to provide a platform for very busy government officials who don't often have time to sit back and think about the longer term strategic issues. I mean, I know that from my time in the U.S. government. You think you'll have time to ponder, where we're going and how we get there, but often you're just firefighting every day because of various conflicts that come up. So think tanks like RUSI provide that platform. They convene the right people to come together on the record, off the record, to help, those in positions of power debate and consider various options so that hopefully they make more informed decisions. I mean, we can't, our ambitions are not to change the world, but really to contribute and to try to provide more information or as much as we can and creative ideas when we can as well.
So, Karen, you've got a few more weeks left. Who's moving into your office after you leave?
Well, I'm very excited that a very talented woman has been chosen to succeed me. Her name is Rachel Ella Hughes. She's been the American Secretary of Defense lead person at NATO, and she has a very enormous, significant amount of experience in defense in particular, but defense and security. So I think she will be able to really take RUSI to the next level. And I'm really happy to be handing the reins over to her.
And what about you? What's next for you?
I'm going to be hanging around. So I'll be available if you call and going to try to take some time out and just think about what next. It's so hard to be thinking about what next when you're in the middle of a very busy job. So I just take a bit of time out and then think through, various options, maybe do some writing, et cetera.
So it's a watch this space. But Karen, yes, you're very welcome to come back on SITREP. We've always enjoyed our conversations with you. So talk to you again soon then.
Okay. Thank you, Kate.